A Lookout Landing podcast with a little bit somber tone, Jeff, after this last night's game.
Was that a prompt? That wasn't even a
That was
sentence.
A prompt, yes.
That was a collection of words that I think was meant to get me to talk, which it turns out it succeeded, but it was a...
Delayed.
Full sentence. Yes, last night's game was a bummer of a game, and this podcast will be posted, I guess, shortly before Friday night's game, so hopefully that gives us an opportunity to move on. But even if the Mariners win, and even if the Mariners win three or four games in a row, we're still going to reflect on, well, what happened last Felix Day? Oh, right. We lost. What could have been the moment of the season?
I don't know. Maybe you will. I won't.
I mean, it would be great if the Mariners win some games, but it's just... I mean, so we talked about the Wednesday effect last time we did this and how fantastic it was to watch the Mariners do that, just how good it felt. That gives us something to lean on. And then we had another, the same kind of feeling with Felix's performance in the eighth inning. That was just going to be something that we could think about all season long. Even next year, we could still reflect on. Now it's gone because it's just tainted, and there's nothing we can do about it. So it's disappointing from a fan's perspective. But at least, I guess the silver lining is, I mean, Felix looked pretty fucking amazing. So next time.
Yeah, he did look really good. I don't know. Maybe it's just a difference in memory or something, but I don't think, like, even if the Mariners had held on to a 1-0 lead, like, I wouldn't have really paid much attention to the game down the line. I don't think, like, after a bummer of a loss in June, I would think back to, like, oh, well, at least Felix was awesome that one night. That was a really cool game. Like, I just don't really reflect on baseball that way.
It was the lift. It wasn't so much Felix's performance, it was the way that it ended, which kind of involved his whole performance, but just the way he came off the mound. I've never seen him that expressive, and he's been very expressive before. And
it yes.
was one of those, like, you think of, you know how the NHL makes really awesome playoff commercials?
Yes.
I think that was one of those moments that would belong in, like, if MLB did playoff commercials as well as hockey does, you would have that image of Felix coming off the mound, and then we would see it, and we would get chills because we would remember it. And it was just going to be
right.
one of
it would
of
it would
those.
Be a meaningful moment and things. It would be perfect in, like, an end of season highlight video and all that stuff, like, assuming the rest of the season goes well. But if the Mariners, like, finish 73-89, I'm not going to be like, I think that would overturn, like, the chill factor of that one inning for me.
I mean,
April.
They missed the playoffs in 2007. Granted, they were a decent team in 2007, but maybe it's just because I was there, but the whole Felix one-hitter in Fenway is still kind of one of those things for me where it doesn't matter that the Mariners had Lollapalooza and then the disastrous August and September, because I still think back on that and think, I am so lucky to have witnessed that, and haha, Boston. And actually, I wanted to jump off real quick, and we'll come back to Felix later on, but I think today is like Fenway's 100th anniversary or something. And then we get into this question where I think all of Fenway has been renovated or replaced. So, I mean, it's the parcel of land, I think, has hosted baseball for 100 years. But is it really Fenway's 100th anniversary? I think somebody just talked about this the other day. It's like a...
You know, like, every cell in your body is not an original cell. You've replaced everything. So when it's your birthday, is it really your birthday?
Well, right. There was a commenter who taught me the name of this is the Ship of Theseus paradox, which I had never known before. Where are you familiar with the Ship of Theseus paradox?
I probably am, but not by name.
I'll give you the quick summary from Wikipedia. It's a paradox that raises the question of whether an object which has had all of its component parts replaced remains fundamentally the same object. Blah blah blah.
Yeah.
It has to do with a ship that was completely restored, replacing all of its parts. We don't care about the Greek mythology part. We care about Fenway. I'm pretty sure just as your body has been replaced, what is it, like every 6 years you have all new cells or something?
Well, it's not, like, uniform that way.
Well, no, I know, but, like, after a six-year period, you would have had... Anyway, so...
I'm not sure if that's actually true. The number that I've heard quoted is 7 years, and I'm not sure if that's entirely true, because I think there are things that don't, like, neurons, I don't think, get recycled.
I don't know.
In the same way, like, you build new ones, and ones die, but I don't think they get recycled in the same way that, like, skin cells do, but... Whatever. I'm not a biologist.
Yeah, now we're talking about neuroscience, but it would be interesting to think about. It's one thing for, like, a skin cell to regenerate, because what does skin do? It covers you. But, like, a neuron, these things store memories and, like, behavior.
Well,
and
I mean, they're just electric synapses, so they're not actually that complicated. It's the interplay that works, you know, but...
It's just weird to think about.
They're basically just, like, binary bits in a computer that just on or off.
Yeah,
but whatever.
Conditioned by your...
Let's not talk about neuroscience, because that's a subject beneath us, and let's get back to Felix and baseball.
So, obviously, it was shitty, and I don't really hold it against Brandon Lee too much. He'll blow saves. It happens. I really want to be critical of Miguel Oliva's framing, but it's not fair, I don't think, for one thing, because I think we've been piling on Oliva a lot, and...
That doesn't... I don't care.
And also... I think
that's a shitty...
More importantly, I think it's got to be really difficult to frame a pitcher like Felix or Brandon Lee. And it's not fair for me to jump on Oliva immediately for questionable framing, because it's not something I notice very often, so I can't...
I'm free to totally do it, because I notice it a lot. And it's not like it comes out of nowhere. We have evidence that Miguel Oliva is bad at pitch framing and has been bad at pitch framing. So it's not just picking a small sample or whatever, and it's a criticism that we've made before and have noticed before, and at pointing out, in particular in this one case, it looks like it could have mattered.
Well, I'm pulling up now, Mike Fast, sorry to interrupt you, but I just pulled up the article, and I'm looking at this. I had the recollection that you had that Miguel Oliva was shown to be bad, but it turns out Fast shows him at one run below average for 120 games, so he's effectively been an average catcher at framing, which is bad.
But that's bad.
Average?
Eh. What was this like?
But last year he was +6. He actually hasn't... He was negative most recently in 2009, if you want to believe Fast's numbers, which you're free to quibble with them if you want. But I also thought that we knew that Oliva was bad at framing, but it turns out it was like Jojima, who was terrible at framing him.
Well, I don't think being below average means not bad.
Well, but one run below average per 120 games, that's nothing.
Eh,
well,
whatever.
I think it's one, but... You know, it's a run. I don't really care about anything until we start talking fives and tens.
But, like, nobody is that bad.
Ryan Domet shows up at negative 26. Kenji Jojima shows up at negative 15. Rob Johnson, negative 16. There are pitchers down there, but Oliva is just kind of in the middle.
A lot of those, I think, are small samples. You're dealing with a lot less data. But whatever. This is a pointless conversation right here. Miguel Oliva exhibits bad catch framing at times. He's clearly not a consistently average or even consistently good or whatever. And it's more what I'm talking about is that the two things that Mike Fast in that article, to use that his methodology, noticed that contribute to poor catch or pitch framing is the moving glove and the dropping head. And in my opinion, the things that I wanted to criticize, two low pitches to whoever that was, well, I can't remember who it was.
Was it Duncan, I think?
Yes, I think it was Duncan. Pitches that PitchFX game day showed to be at the bottom of the strike zone. Visually, they appeared to be roughly at the knees. They certainly wouldn't have surprised me to call strikes. They were also pretty still borderline. I'm not saying they were guaranteed strikes that Miguel Oliva was totally at fault for, but in both cases, he caught the ball and dropped his glove.
Mm-hmm.
His glove moved out of the strike zone to catch the ball. So I have no doubt that he at least exasperated the borderline-ness of the pitch and made it more likely for them to be called balls. Now, I'm not saying it's totally Miguel Oliva's fault. It's fractionally Miguel Oliva's fault. Less so than Brandon Leake's fault. Still more Brandon Leake's fault.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost entirely the offense's fault. And frankly, I put more blame on Miguel Oliva for the inning-ending double play, the third inning or second inning or whatever inning it was. Like, God. It's just, I don't care that we've been harping on him a lot recently. He deserves it. When we harp on him for things that we don't, that he doesn't deserve, that's when I draw the line. But ignoring that he was the catcher is not correct either.
Right, and the double play turned out to be the most important Mariners at bat of the game, where it lost 12% of winning expectancy, if you care about that, etc. It would have been a good chance for the Mariners to get the lead, of course, they didn't, because Oliva, who should not have been playing in the first place, I think we both probably agree that it should have been Jaso behind the plate, or Montero behind the plate, and the other one DHing, or something, just against a right-handed pitcher.
A right-handed hitter. Pitcher, yeah.
Oliva double play, and then you get to the ninth inning, and I'm looking at the pitch effects data right now, and I'm looking at randomly through a total of three pitches that are just right on the very bottom edge of the strike zone, and maybe one or two of those goes a different way with another catcher. Probably not all three, but just for all three to be balls, all three to be important balls, it completely swung the Duncan. I think it was Duncan. I'm going to assume it was Duncan to bet. And it just, it doesn't help. And I noticed it, and it stood out to me. You notice catcher framing all the time. I don't. So when I notice that, and I'm usually watching the hitter or Brandon Lee or the fans or something, but that stood out to me, and I thought, I saw Oliva drop his glove twice for low fastballs, and I thought, well, hold on, that didn't look like he was that far out of the zone, but Oliva just treated it like he was practically a ball in the dirt.
Yes.
I mean, it's no wonder that the umpire
isn't going to call that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't hold it. He didn't hold his glove. He didn't try to frame it at all. He treated it like a ball in the dirt. And it was like, that's...
In fact, here, Lee got ahead of... It was Shelley Duncan, and Lee got ahead of Duncan 0-1. His next pitch was a fastball bottom of the strike zone.
Yep.
Turned it to 0-2 instead of his 1-1. His next pitch was a fastball at the bottom of the strike zone. Could have turned it to 1-2 or been a strikeout or whatever. But it's just, I mean, these are critical. Those would have been, get either one of those pitches and it's a 2-strike count. And that's, well, Brandon Lee throws a splitter and voila. Yeah.
And then it's 2 outs. And then the infield can play back. And then who knows what happens, because that's, you can't then assume everything else stays the same. But,
yeah.
I mean, who knows? But it's... It's worth calling out, because it just goes back to that point. What does Miguel Oliva provide this team? On the field, there's no argument, I think, that can be made that he's not. I mean, he might be the worst. I think he's the worst position player on the team. Yes, is there anybody worse?
Even
accounting for the fact that he plays catcher.
I can't think of anybody. I guess maybe part of it depends on what you think of, how good you think Michael Saunders actually is, but he can't be the worst because he plays defense.
But he plays in center field.
I mean, maybe you would say Jesus Montero if you believe he's only this hitter and he's a DH, but of course he's not.
He's
neither. So I think Olivo is, at this point, I would pick him as the worst position player on the team. And there are some other guys who are close, but I would give the benefit of the doubt to, like, Figgins. I assume he's better because, Olivo's the worst. Let's just leave it there.
Yeah.
He is the worst, even among the bench bats too. I think there's not a player on the bench.
That's what I'm saying. Like, and I think even you could almost break it down component wise. Like, is there a worst hitter against, especially like in that situation against a right-handed starting pitcher? Like, is there a worse hitter on the team?
I thought it was actually worse to have. Did Oliva start against Lowe or Masterson? He started against.
He did not start against Masterson.
Right, he started against Lowe, and I thought that was a worse matchup because Lowe throws nothing but pitches out of the strike zone. It's actually unbelievable how few strikes he throws. But like Tomlin, intuitively, I think it makes some sense because Tomlin pounds his zone. But I don't know if that's actually true. I don't know if that matters. It seems too simple. But
well, it still doesn't matter in the sense that like but Miguel Oliva's aggressive, and you want to be aggressive. But also, Miguel Oliva doesn't hit strikes either. He doesn't hit anything. Like, the benefit Miguel Oliva gets from facing a guy who throws pitches in the zone is the same that anybody else would have gotten. They're easier to hit strikes. You just have to be aggressive at it. It's not... Maybe, you know, the argument would have to be that Miguel Oliva is a better starter over X because X is somebody who tries to, like... a Figgins or something like that, but that's not a compare. That's not a choice that is made. It's like, well, was he better starter than Jesus Montero in this case? Like, no. Than John Jaso? Clearly not, because of platoon. It's just against a right-handed pitcher. Like, is there anybody you would have less confidence in as a hitter?
Oh, there's nobody I have less confidence in as a hitter against any pitcher than Miguel Lillo.
And secondly, is there anybody on this team who's worse at defending their position than Miguel Oliva?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah.
What's interesting, so there has to be some reason that Eric Wedge, former catcher, is like, I don't think John Jaso is much of a catcher. He hasn't said that out loud, but it's strongly implied that Jaso...
I don't know if it's that he doesn't think Jaso is much of a catcher, or if he's just that one of those people that's just Miguel Oliva, their starting catcher. End of story. It never gets beyond that. Miguel Oliva was here first.
I guess it will be interesting to see, because it's still early, because we don't yet take numbers too seriously. Like, I don't think Justin Smoke is going to be a 640 OPS bat this year, although, concerned. Same with Montero. I think we can give... I'm still disappointed, of course, that Olivo is playing as much as he is. I don't think that it should be happening, but I'll wait, and I'll see where things are in, like, June. If Olivo's still not contributing at the plate, his defense obviously isn't going to improve, and if the playing time is still being split up like it is now, there will be even less of an excuse for the Mariners to be playing Olivo as much as they are, assuming they're not really involved in the race. At that point, it's like, well, Jaso's still, he's 28. He's not a grandfather like Miguel Olivo is, literally a grandfather. So then it will be really interesting. And then at that point, if Eric Wedge is still like, Miguel Olivo's a starting catcher, it's like, no, you know what? You were being too stubborn, and now you're actually hurting what the organization is going for. Why won't you take him out of Wedge's hands, Jack Zarensic? Why don't you just get rid of him? But now I'm drifting.
I don't have that long of a leash. Because it's not just this one thing. I mean, it's like it's a lot of things put together, but this is just the capsule on it, or the perfect example. But I'm sick of Eric Wedge. I'm sick of Miguel Olivo.
Well, what did you think about Eric Wedge last year? What was your opinion of him?
I didn't like him, but I didn't think he was actively hurting the team to a great amount.
Sorry about the sound effect.
Like, I didn't think there was enough information on him, and the team was generally terrible, so it was kind of hard to be like, whatever. But I don't think there was a similar situation last year where he was playing somebody clearly. I mean, I guess you could talk about Carlos Baguero. But yeah. I was at that time more, I guess, willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, because what I complained about at the time was like, why is Carlos Baguero on the team and Mike Karp in Tacoma? Like, they need to see what Mike Karp is better. And once it became abundantly clear that Carlos Baguero can't play defense in the outfield, there was like, there's no point. There's no way that Carlos Baguero is a better player than Mike Karp. You need to see what Mike Karp can do. But the fact was that Mike Karp was in Tacoma and Carlos Baguero was in Seattle. So to a point, I was like, well, there's only so much Eric Wedge can do because he doesn't get to control the transactions. He only gets to control who plays. So given that, I wasn't totally willing to blame him. Now, his comments about like the batting practice, home runs, and all that kind of stuff are like suspicious, but again, it's like I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. He's not going to come out and trash his player to the press. No manager will do that and be manager for very long. So I'm not going to hold it against him that he praised Baguero, but you know, you start adding these things up. If the Carlos Baguero thing happens this year, he's not getting the benefit of the doubt anymore.
It's hard with Eric Wedge, because we don't really understand Mariners that well. You're inclined to look for ways that we might undervalue them or not understand them, and you think Eric Wedge, well, he strikes one as like a very powerful motivator. Well, okay, it makes sense. Like, a manager needs to be a good motivator, right? And that's probably true. The Mariners certainly seem to have a certain loyalty to Eric Wedge. They seem to love him. They seem as like a long-term leader. But then you look at pretty much any analysis of managers, for whatever those are worth, show that Eric Wedge isn't very good. And if we see that Eric Wedge has demonstrated, he had this problem in Cleveland too. Maybe it's not a problem, but it's a little quirk of his, that he just kind of forgets people on the roster. Like, he just doesn't use them. And, I mean, he's not using John Jay so much, but more importantly, there's like Casper Wells who's not playing. Hisashi Iwakuma hasn't played at all. He's on a team. I mean, we're almost a tenth of the way into the season. He's on the team. He hasn't done anything. I think I've seen him warm up maybe once. He's Steve Delabar is warming up all the goddamn time. It's like, are you even paying attention to Steve Delabar pitching? And then with the Olivo thing, it's just, you know, Wedge, you're certain to, but from what we can evaluate, it doesn't seem like you're really good, but from what the way people talk about you, like, I want to believe that the man, like, I'll have to take the team's opinion on the manager more than a player, because at least with a player, we have evidence of what the player can do or has done, but with Wedge, it just seems like maybe this is not the right guy to hit your wagon to, if that's the expression, which I'm pretty sure it's not.
Right, and that's reasonable. The only a counter to that would be that the opinions of baseball people are generally stupid. You know, baseball players loved Jose Vedro, even years after he was terrible, because they're like, he's a 300 hitter. Well, one, no, he's not. And two, that's all he is, because he can't, he doesn't walk anymore, and he can't hit for power worth shit. So, I don't know, people, baseball players are, I mean, a lot of it they can't probably help. They're steep, they've spent their entire lives around people like Eric Wedge. Yeah, so, but I, there's a limit to how much, I think it's probably, yes, it's kind of the best evidence we have, but it's really, it's not evidence. I don't know. I want Miguel Olivo gone. If you took away that, then I wouldn't really care about Eric Wedge at all. Up until the point where Carlos Baggio is playing every day again.
Or Steve Delabar is pitching all the time, but it's not like I can pretend to have a huge thing against Steve Delabar, because before Tom Wilhelmsen, it's not like there's really much that's clear in the bullpen. Who else do you trust?
Yeah. Nobody. And it's not like Delabar was terrible last year.
No, actually, the weird thing about Delabar is I don't trust his command at all, but while he's given up 4 home runs, he's also got 0 walks, so who knows really what to make of Steve Delabar at this point. I'm just, like a few other people, I think I'm just kind of waiting for his arm to fall off because he's got that whole, his backstory, so it kind of feels like he's in a race against time to pitch as much as he can before he's completely fucked. But, I mean, you at this rate, the Mariners need like a third or fourth reliever because you're not going to be able to ride league and Wilhelmsen as hard as they have been all year long.
Clearly not. Boy, it would have been nice if Hong Chi-Kuo was like not crazy.
He was one of the boring kinds of crazy too, where he wasn't even like interesting to talk to. He was just bad. Like there was something mentally off with his pitching. But I mean, I guess you can look for Sean Kelly to come back soon, and maybe Chance Ruffin comes up soon. Or I mean,
Sean Kelly's been so good in Tacoma.
I haven't checked in the last few days, but I'm going to assume he has like no walks and lots of strikeouts. What I see is that he has 3 walks and 12 strikeouts. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it would help to have him back. And I guess you've mentioned, I don't know if you've mentioned it on the site or whatever, but somebody like a Carter Capps.
Yeah.
We could really, So the bullpen needs reinforcements. It's a huge, huge weakness in the team right now.
And Capps, you'll remember, was like a high pick last year, and he just seems to be an organizational favorite, where there's some people who think, oh, Capps should be starting, but right now he's in the bullpen and he's just pretty much unhittable. He has the kind of stuff that can move quick. He's got deception, he's got velocity. Maybe he's one of those relievers who burns out in a hurry, but you might as well use him now. I mean, it didn't take the Angels long to bring up Francisco Rodriguez. We saw the impact he had, and Capps could be a dominant. I mean, you can start him out and, like I said, well, I don't want to get ahead of myself and start talking about Carter Capps because he's not even in AAA yet. But, I mean, there are options, and the neat thing about a bullpen is that while the Mariners' bullpen right now is unreliable, who knows what it is in 2 months? I mean, it's nice to have league is probably steady, and Wilhelmsen is probably steady.
Sean Kelly certainly can be if he's healthy, and the long men seem fine. Mm-hmm. Got no problem with that. Furbush is adequate at that job. I imagine Iwakuma, if he ever gets a chance, would be adequate at that job, or even somebody like a Blake Bevin if he gets pushed to the bullpen because of our awesome other starting pitchers down in the minors or something like that. It's just, it's kind of those middle innings and needing to get pressure off of Brandon League and et cetera. Like, this, God, there was no point in bringing him in on a 4-1 game. But nope. Just like there was really no point in bringing him in the ninth inning last night to face a switch hitter and 2 lefties. Like, you don't want that. You should use a left-hander right there. But nope, it's the ninth inning. It's fucking stupid.
Yeah, but then I guess that isn't really a problem with Eric Wedge. It's a problem.
No, and I said as much. Like, that's not an Eric Wedge problem. That's just a baseball problem. But it's like, it's ridiculous that stands. Like, that is so stupid. I don't care how much, I mean, well, I do care, but there's no way that Brandon League is better than, like, Charlie Furbush against those left-handed hitters. Like, the platoon's advantage matters. And also Schofield Park factors matter. And turning Santana around to bat on the right side and neutralizing or forcing pinch hits for, like, well, they weren't going to pinch hit for Hafner, but neutralizing Hafner and maybe forcing a pinch hitter instead of Kochman would have been a right-handed one too. Like, hey, Jose Lopez or something. Like, that's more helpful for the Mariners. That probably would have made them more likely to win. And there was no need to use Brennan League in a three-run game in the ninth inning. Like, that, hey, Iwakuma, let him pitch.
Yeah, that's probably not the spot that where Eric Wedge is going to.
Right, no manager would, but I mean, like, there's really fewer, you're not going to find a lot of lower leverage situations than that. They want to talk about easing him in. They always talk about, like, putting in blowouts. Like, well, what about a 3 or 4 run lead in the ninth inning? You can have the closer warming up, too, still, and just be like, hey, here you go. If you load the bases, then we'll pull you. Or something. I don't know. It's just, God, it's so stupid. Baseball's just dumb.
You just send him out to the mound. Hey, get in there. But if you load the bases, I'm going to kill you. Don't load the bases. This is all rides on this. It is weird to think that a year ago we had the whole Jeff Gray thing, which I still can't believe that he had like 2 appearances in 2 months. It's almost unbelievable to me that he could just be out there so neglected. And it's now insane that we're going through it again. And the pitching staff has been whatever, okay. And it's not like I think Iwakuma is going to be some sort of godsend, but I just can't believe that we have another neglected reliever that's getting paid millions of dollars. It wasn't even like a waiver claim.
Yeah.
Like Jeff Gray was, where the Mariners wanted to be able to send Will Helmsen to the minors.
We thought he was going to be in the rotation. We all thought he was going to be in the rotation, and now he's not pitched. 14 games into the season.
I remember when the Mariners gave him a 1-year contract, and they're like, well, if he's good, if he demonstrates that he's good, well, then we'll talk about an extension. Well, and then there's no guarantee that he'll be a free agent next year. Well, it's like, I don't think he's going to want to come back, you guys, even if he's good. Like, he's
or maybe he really will, because he doesn't want, like, it's a pretty cushy job.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Iwakuma's just got, he's got a maid. But you imagine being like the Japanese media is just waiting for him to get in. Family's traveling with the team, just trying to wait to see his first game. It's just, nope, not now. And then you have 15 Japanese reporters just like sweating through daily articles about Hisashi Iwakuma update, and he stirred in the fifth inning, but he was getting a cup of water. And it'll be interesting to see when he pitches and what the situation is when he pitches, and if it's going to be because he's actually selected to pitch or because the team is just out of relievers or it's an early blowout or what have you. But I guess, I mean, we'll see what happens if any of the starters blow up. I don't know who would. Bevin's never going to be terrible. Millwood, they'll let her bump.
Yeah, who knows?
It'll be interesting. Actually, with Erasmo Ramirez, I wonder how much trust. He's only pitched 3 games, but the last 2 haven't been very good. And I wonder, he was brought up because he can
throw strikes, and he's not really throwing strikes.
The ball at all. Even when he's throwing strikes, he's been missing a lot of spots. So I wonder how long his leash is, but he's got an identical role to.
Yeah, well, he really probably should go back down, and Iwakuma should get the innings that he was getting, and then we should not bring up a reliever in his place, because we clearly don't need one.
Well, yeah, but are we really going to use a position player if we bring him up either? The answer is no. It would just ignore him. So really, they just should bring up... You know what they should do, is as long as they're not going to use a 25th man, they should just bring up somebody who's never going to get another chance. Like, bring up, I don't know, Luis Jimenez or Scott Savastano and just be like, hey, you're in the majors. I mean, you're not going to play, so don't even, like, have a uniform. You can just sit by the dugout. But, hey, you're on the team. Just collect your money.
We should re-sign Jose Yepes and bring him back up.
Anthony Vasquez.
Poor Yepes.
You just
Anthony Vasquez. God, I don't even care that he's been really good in Tacoma. God,
he hasn't been really good. He has 9 strikeouts and 3 starts. He's not...
Okay, but I mean, like, results-base-wise, it's been really good because he's given up, like, 1 run in those 3 starts. But it's – I know he's been Anthony Vasquez, and I'm just like, no, never again.
And I don't actually – even if Anthony Vasquez turns out to get strikeouts in Tacoma, I never want to see him again because I don't want him to spoil his line.
Yeah, just trade him. Just trade him. Numbers.
No, don't trade him. Don't give him a shot. Just
no, well, I don't want him to retire. Like, I don't hold it against him or anything. Just, like, trade him to the National League or something.
There's no way, as one who appreciates art, you cannot taking.
I don't appreciate art.
As part of a society that generally appreciates art, you can't take Anthony Vasquez and look at his numbers and think, I want him to have a chance to spoil those numbers. Because, I mean, there's probably not a chance.
That's not what I'm saying, though. I'm not saying I want him to spoil those numbers or I want him to have a chance. I just don't want it to be him to not have a chance.
I do. Fuck him.
I'm just not that mean-spirited.
You didn't watch the Mariners on TV last year like I did.
No, I didn't.
What a weird guy to force into the rotation. We need bodies, so we will literally just take a warm body with arms. Start seven times, see what you do. You average four innings a start. So many things about baseball are unbelievable. The Mariners give no innings to Jeff Gray and seven starts to Anthony Vasquez.
Or how about the Mariners being 3-3 in this homestand and their three losses have been two awesome Felix starts in a game where they scored eight runs?
Yeah, it's really easy to look at the Mariners so far and you look at the games that they have lost, and they lost a game to Oakland and Japan where they had a late lead, and they lost a game to Texas where they piled on Darvish early. They lost a game to Texas 1-0. They lost to the Indians where they blew a 7-run lead. They lost to the Indians with the league in the 9th inning. It's like all these games, it's like, hey, the Mariners, they were really close. They could have had a fantastic record by now. Of course, even if the Mariners did have a fantastic record right now,
it wouldn't change their underlying performance, which is still that the offense is kind of shitty. And the bullpen is sketchy.
Yeah, and we still...
The offense is better, but it does still seem to have that remnant of... And I don't think there's any kind of, like, personality to ascribe to the whole team about this, but it does just seem like that when they score runs early, I never feel like they're going to keep scoring runs later. Yeah. I don't know why they... It just seems like... It's probably just a remnant from last year or whatever when they just didn't score runs at all, but they get to four runs, and I'm like, oh, well, they're done.
Yeah, well, I think that's just kind of what it is with a pretty bad offense.
I don't think it's like an actual personality or anything like that. But it's just God, that narrative, it just feels that way, and it's so ugh. Because then I'm like, well, don't allow any runs, pitchers. And that's I don't know. Just want them to hit.
I just hit a mental wall where I couldn't think of anything to say.
All right. Well, I will toss this in there totally disjointed, but about Felix and about last night, I mentioned it on Twitter, but I did see somebody commenting on the recap post that they hadn't seen or whatever. So not that person's then going to wade 30 minutes into this podcast to find out. But so Felix last night averaged 92 on his fastball, 89 on his change, 86 on his slider, 82 on his curve. Last year, he was 93 on his fastball, 89 on his change, same speed, 86 on his slider, same speed, 82 on his curve, same speed. So basically, last night versus last season, the only difference was like about a mile per hour on his fastball only. Everything else was back to normal. So that's still only one start, and who knows, Safeco Gun or Safeco Pitch FX, these things aren't exactly platonic ideals, but it's certainly not the Felix is topping out at 90 and his change is 85 like we kind of saw at the end of spring training.
Right. Yeah, no, it's coming back, and you look at a guy like Felix and ordinarily you would think, well, maybe pitchers build up during the course of the season, which I think has been proven on a general level that pitchers' velocity increases until like June or July when it maxes out. A year ago, Felix was strong in April, so it's not like he's necessarily been a slow starter before.
Yeah.
But at this point, I mean, there's nothing really to complain about with his performance, and his stuff seems to be coming back. He's not topping out at 89 or 90 like he seemed to be, which was very concerning, and I didn't really appreciate being dismissed by the team saying it's nothing to worry about, because it was something to worry about, but now it's probably not. Now I think we can trust him. And he threw a lot of pitches yesterday, so I'm glad that he's hopefully going to be pitching on an extra day's rest.
Yes.
But I'm pretty much over my Felix concern now, although it'd be interesting to see the ground balls. But he got ground balls against Cleveland, so.
Yes. Yeah, 10 of 17 balls in play were grounders, so that's a perfectly adequate rate for Felix. So. And, yeah, it's again, one of those things where it's just like, and we mentioned this beforehand, but when you're dealing with small samples early in the season, it's not just that they're small samples. It's also that they're... So, I mean, I think most people, when they think of small sample, they're just like, okay, it's a small sample, but that means I can't draw conclusions, or I shouldn't draw conclusions from this. Somebody hits a home run in the first game, you're like, oh, well, that doesn't mean he's going to hit a home run every game. The other part about it is that for baseball and things, we rely so much on kind of this kind of assumption that's not necessarily wrong or whatever, but that players play a representative sample of opponents, so that we don't have to do things. And it can come up at times. You'll see sometimes, like in Cy Young races towards the end of the year, people will go back and look at actually like who has had to face the tougher batters. I think there was an argument last year in the National League or 2 years ago with like the Cliff Lee versus Clayton Kershaw and Tim Lincecum and all that kind of stuff. But it's important to realize that in the early going, because things like Felix had basically faced the Oakland Athletics, and the Oakland Athletics don't hit a lot of ground balls. So yeah, it's a small sample, but it's also, you need to adjust these things first. It's not just like, you don't need to just regress them. You also need to realize like who these teams have played, who the Mariner batters have faced. There's a reason why they didn't draw any walks in the first 11 games of the season. Partly probably because talent-wise they're not going to draw a lot of walks, but also because look who they faced. They faced pitchers who weren't drawing walks or didn't throw balls out of strike zone.
Yeah, I mean, they faced Bartolo Colon a couple times, right? And he just threw 38 strikes in a row. Like, yeah. Hey, I mean, when you have – I think people – and we've talked about this and we don't need to go into it a great deal again, but people look at walk rate like it's so important. But no, what is important is just not swinging at bad pitches. And if the pitchers aren't throwing bad pitches, well, there's nothing you can do as a hitter. I guess you can foul pitches off until they make a mistake, but that's not the point. The point is to hit strikes. The Mariners' problem is that they don't really hit strikes very well right now.
Yes.
And, of course, I mean, Miguel Lebo is the world's worst approach, but he's not the team. He's one guy on the team where there's a lot of players on the team that I trust to mostly swing at strikes. The problem is hitting those strikes well, and they haven't done that yet. Presumably they get better. Hopefully they get better. But I think people still aren't real clear on what play discipline is and why it's important and how it manifests. And the Mariners so far have actually been good at it. Other results be damned.
Yeah, their approach has been fine. The problem has been what happens when they swing. It's not about when and what they swing at so far as a team. Not for certain players, yes, but overwhelmingly for the team, it's been fine. And I don't know. I hate to beat the luck drum, too, again, especially since it seems to happen all the time. But, boy, it seems they've been getting kind of unlucky. Like a lot of line drives, it feels like. But maybe that's just all Kyle Seager. And I'm not paying attention.
Well, I
to
think
the other hitters.
Well, so we've seen Saunders hit some balls. The problem, I think, is that we, just because of the way that we're programmed, we see balls hit hard that are caught, and then we kind of forget about the balls that are hit soft and aren't caught. But I do feel like I actually checked yesterday, and I think the Mariners have the league's highest line drive rate, if you care about line drive rate, which was sort of a surprise and sort of not, because to my memory, they've hit a lot of line drives. It's not just Seager, but it's also Saunders. It's also Fagan, Suzanne,
Ichiro.
Line drives. Ichiro has been hitting the ball really hard, and he's not hitting the ball 440 feet because I don't think he can, but he's had a lot of well-hit balls in center and right field. So I do think the Mariners have been getting a little unlucky given the quality of contact. So there's that, but I also know that we've made those remarks in the past and we've wound up getting burned even though the remarks at the time were true, so I'm kind of hesitant to try to use it to get people encouraged now. But it's like, oh, I remember what happened last time. What happened last time was 2010 and 2011.
Yeah.
2010, when I was writing posts like, by the way, the Mariners are just out of first place, and then they, you know, Eric Burns and everything, which, by the way, was only 2 years ago, about roughly today, or in 2 weeks.
Which, wow, he gets way too much crap for that.
Yeah. God, that was a really hard pitch to bunt.
It was an impossible pitch to bunt, and all, I mean, literally, he could not have made contact with everybody everybody just focused on the fact that he like instinctively drew the bat back and then tried to bunt it again. It was like, yeah, but I mean, he's counteracting like 20 years of baseball instinct to be like, the ball is in the dirt and in the other batter's box. I can't bunt this. I should draw my bat back to take it for a ball. Like, that's really hard to overcome.
Earlier
this week, it was like a microsecond of reaction time, and everybody just flayed him for it.
Earlier this week, I don't know if you saw, some people probably saw, the Red Sox lost to the Rays 1-0. Cody Ross got punched out on strikes to end the game in the bottom of the ninth with, like, the winning run on base or something. I don't actually remember the situation very well, but Cody Ross was called out on strikes with Fernando Rodney throwing five pitches that were out of the zone. They were all out of the zone. Three of them were called strikes. Ross didn't swing at one, and he struck out. I thought it was kind of funny because Red Sox, but whatever. And Ross was understandably upset because he didn't see a strike, but he got called out on strikes. And some people were arguing with him, like, well, hey, we're arguing about him, saying, well, you should have known based on the other pitches that there's going to be a strike, so you should have protected, etc. But then, if you're Cody Ross, how fast do you think you can overwrite muscle memory and just the entire experience of
your career? You have what? Like a quarter of a second to decide whether to swing at a pitch or something like that? Like, that's, you can't be like, oh, not a strike. Oh, wait, well, based on recent history of the, oh, no, it's two pitches later already. That's really hard.
I think it's funny when people start talking about umpire tendencies and how players should take those into account. Like, you know what? They probably have enough on their minds. You can't just adjust to these things on a game-by-game level. There is a point at which I think you might be overthinking the game, and maybe as a pitcher it's good to be aware of umpire tendencies. As a hitter, I don't think it's going to help. You can't go into a game and think this umpire calls some more strikes, maybe up and away, so I have to be more... No, you have to go with just your approach, and you can't customize on a day-to-day basis. Maybe that's one of those things where you need to have some playing experience to understand, but I don't think that's true because I didn't really hit, and I still think it's silly. but people, I think, are... People are too critical of players generally. There are times when people might not be critical enough, or they are appropriately critical, but maybe there are times when people don't understand the difficulty of hitting. Go to a batting cage and face pitches that are 50 miles per hour. 50, and you'll be like, whoa, there's not a whole lot of time between when the ball comes out and when I have to swing. Okay, well, now double that and make the pitcher good instead of a pitching machine.
Yeah, not just fastballs.
Yeah. Shit's hard. So, Eric Burns, I don't absolve you completely, but because you did some weird
shit. I don't absolve him for, like, batting 087 coming into that point, which I think was the frustration where a lot of people had with him. But it's just like, you guys picked the most ridiculous flashpoints for this shit. Like, that was such a not good example to be so pissed about. Especially when the entire offense like hadn't scored up to that point through 10 innings. Like, you know what? Everybody was fucking terrible. God. At least he was wacky and fun.
You were left on a bicycle. Jesus Christ. He had such a better ending than Griffey did.
Yeah.
Griffey had the worst ending ever. I kind of want to feel like apologizing to listeners because I don't think either of us is in a real groove with this podcast. I haven't felt comfortable or enthusiastic, but last night's game kind of took some wind out of my sails, and there's also just not that much interesting to talk about at the moment.
Yeah, I'm both kind of waiting for something, I guess, a narrative to show up about the team. Like, the bullpen's been bad, but who knows, because the bullpen gets replaced so much, and the hitting's been better, but still bad, but then also, like, the process has been really encouraging. Like, they hit a lot, like you mentioned, they hit a lot of line drives. They seem to have, like, one of the, so far, baseball's best plate approaches. What really can we ask for other than, like, more power?
Yeah, and then, you know, Karp will come back soon, and Gutierrez will be back, hopefully, shortly after that. Not that we can count on Gutierrez to hit for much power or Karp to hit for much anything. In fact, Karp's only going to make the play discipline numbers worse, which is a weird thing to say, given what we used to think about Mike Karp. But, that'll be an interesting situation when Karp comes back, because right now we can see that they're playing Figgins and Seager all the time, and I could rationalize it by saying that, well, they want to find out as much as they can on these guys before they have to make a decision. And I don't know who's going to sit. I guess you could sit Seager.
Olivo!
Right, it should be Olivo, but I think we both know better. And it's interesting because Figgins has shown some promise. He's actually hit the ball hard a lot. He's shown some discipline. But then if Kyle Seager were struggling, I'd be nervous. But Kyle Seager has been probably the best hitter on the team so far. He's been hitting the crap out of the ball. He's not walking, but he's been hitting line drives like nobody's business. Like nobody's business, he's been hitting line drives. It is nobody's business to hit line drives quite like it's Kyle Seager's business. And so Eric Wedge can't ignore that. So it's not like Figgins has been better than Seager in a small sample. So when Karp comes back soon, then there's going to be a decision to make. And I don't know how it's going to be balanced, but if it involves more Figgins than Seager, it's not going to make me too happy.
I don't think that's going to be the result. I think Figgins gets his playing time reduced. I think Karp doesn't get full-time duty. I think they basically kind of have a platoon, and Casper Wells continues to be completely marginalized.
Which is weird for a guy who came Alex over goes and away. Instantly hit home runs last season. Like, Wells hit home runs, and then he got vertigo because he got hit in the head by a baseball. Like, how do you, as a manager, you must just really not like Casper Wells as a person to just sit him on a team that doesn't have power and...
He did also have that really shitty spring training. That totally matters.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so did John Jason. Maybe that's what this is. John Jason had a bad spring training, too, and it's just Kisashi Iwakuma was, bad or good, depending on what numbers you looked at.
Yeah. Well, I think we know what numbers they look at.
I think we've been somewhat negative in a podcast where the Mariners are, at least they're 7-7. They're not the Angels, who are 4-9. And as many wins as the Mariners have is as many games behind first place as the Angels already are.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I'm a Texas Rangers fan, but I'm more of a Rangers fan than an Angels fan. So already the Angels have kind of fucked themselves in terms of the division race, because I can't imagine that...
7 games is a lot to come back from.
Yeah. It's not like the Angels are chasing the... whatever 82-80 Padres team won the NL West that one year. They're chasing maybe the best team in baseball, and they're already 7 games back.
Yeah, you're 7 games back against a team that was, even before the season, rated as better than you.
Yeah.
Not by much. We did think like probably the Rangers and the Angels were probably like, what, maybe 3-4 games separated?
Yeah, they were very close, within margin of error.
Yeah, but... that's hard. It'd be one thing if they were trailing like the Mariners by 7 games. You'd be like, well, they'll probably make that one up.
In like one series.
But the Rangers everybody's just kind of like, well, this division's done.
Yep. They can pretty much start resting guys for the playoffs, I think, at this point. But, I mean, obviously, just as with Yu Darvish, he's been kind of mediocre lately. I still think he's going to be good. With the Angels, I still think they're going to be good. In time, we'll get to the end of the year, they'll have 90, 95 wins, whatever. But, God, it'll be so satisfying to see another team have the Mariners 2008. It's just like, we're so hyped, and then this.
Yeah. Or the thing about the Angels is, I think like the first 14 games is kind of exposed, is their bullpen is really not good. I mean, I think it was like one of those bullpens where you're like, you don't really pay attention to it because it was like okay the year before. And it's like, oh, it's mostly the same guys. And then they struggle. And then you look at it again and you're like, wait a minute. It's mostly the same guys and they're a year older. And now everybody's like 35 on that bullpen. And you're like, oh, that might end up being bad for them.
I mean,
it might not. Really... who knows? They're relievers. But
yeah.
I could definitely like look at it and be like, oh, yeah, you're – given the most relief innings to 39-year-old Jason Isringhausen, and there's 39-year-old LaTroy Hawkins and 37-year-old Takahashi and 36-year-old Scott Downs.
Of course, with the upside of the Angels, that with Weaver, Wills, and Santana and Heron, you're probably not going to be giving that many innings to the bullpen relative to other teams, at least in the long run. So far they've had because
Santana's been terrible.
Yeah. And Wilson is not throwing a whole lot of strikes, so we'll see. But also there's the question of the offense, and I mean, Albert Pujols is fantastic, but I'm not gonna lie, it's kinda nice to have him still sitting on 0 home runs after 13.
Oh, it's more than kinda nice.
Yeah. I mean, he's got 7 doubles. I haven't watched him at all. I actually haven't seen a single Albert Pujols at bat this season that I can think of, but I mean, he had the numbers suggest that his power was down a year ago. And now they signed him for a decade, you guys.
His
power, he doesn't have a home run yet. So, I mean, that is, I enjoy that. And Peter Bordes doesn't have a walk yet, and Vernon Wells looks like a pile of shit again. He's got some power, but he has one walk. He just looks kind of lost, and the whole team just doesn't kind of walk. Kendrys Morales doesn't have a walk yet. Torrey Hunter doesn't have a home run yet. It's just, you look at the Angels and you think, maybe this is one of those teams where they're so hyped, and then you get to June or July, and then you're like, oh, wait, why didn't we see this before?
Yeah.
But I don't know, because they still look really good to me, and I think they will be really good.
They look good on paper, but it certainly is also one of those, like, I could look at the team now and be like, yeah, I could see how this could keep going, though.
The important thing is they're not going to win the division. Not that
probably I'm not
in the Rangers' favor, because they've done enough, but the Rangers are going to be good for a long time. I think we're used to those. The Rangers don't annoy me yet, quite like the Angels have. And they'll get there, but they're not there yet. It would be really nice to see the Rangers not win the World Series, though. I mean, that's what we have over them, right? Not that we've ever won a World Series either, but just the fact that they never have, and they've gotten so devastatingly close. I want to keep that sustaining, because it might be even more painful for them to come so close and for us to not come close at all.
I don't know.
That's not true at all. I'm just...
I don't know. I don't... that whole, like, well, at least they never won a World Series, like, that stuff just... like, to me, what matters is, like, what's happened in the last maybe 10 years. After that, like, before that, like... I don't know. I think that's kind of... I think when fans, like, compare their fanhoods based on, like, what their team did 15 years ago, I'm like, you guys just seem really stupid.
Oh, no, that's completely bullshit. But the fact that no Rangers fan is... I mean, they came within, what, a strike twice last year, and then the year before they were playing the Giants, who were beatable, and then, oh, God, it's just, like, they... It's just... It's a nice little... cloak, defensive cloak that I can wear and think, oh man, the Rangers are so much better than the Mariners, but at least I don't have to deal with coming a strike away from the World Series twice with the pitchers I want on the mound. But here's a little fun fact for you. Obviously, the Rangers are better than everybody so far in the American League, but the Rangers have a run differential plus 46 right now. Mm-hmm. Next best in the American League is plus 11. Yeah. They've kind of been creaming the opponent, but they've also been playing pretty easy opponents, I think. And their playoff odds are already up to 96%, if you believe those. So that's pretty high odds.
Yeah.
We can sit here and poke holes in Yu Darvish if you want to for a little bit. I think we were talking about this before we started recording the podcast, but I don't know if anybody's noticed, and you probably noticed if you're anything like me, which you're not, that Yu Darvish is throwing like 56-57% strikes so far through three starts. Obviously wild against the Mariners, wild against whoever he faced the next time, and wild yesterday against the Tigers. Like, hey, you have congratulations on your really great stuff, but all those Daisuke Matsuzaka comparisons people were writing, that's not just because people are racist. It's also because you kind of like Daisuke Matsuzaka so far. And I saw somebody point out in comments somewhere that in Matsuzaka's first three starts, he actually threw a lot of strikes, so maybe that's a reason right there to not put too much stock in the first three starts. But I am, just as I'm taking delight in the Angels' slow start, I am delighting in Yu Darvish's slow start, because it's like, ah, look what hype does. It's not just the Mariners who get overhyped.
Yeah. It's just, yeah. And I was kind of on that don't get too hyped bandwagon from the start, because I'm just, I think, inherently distrustful of the non-major league numbers. And projecting them to be the greatest player ever based on non-major league numbers. Since we've seen it with Matt Wieters and Daisuke Matsuzaka.
Yeah, you just can't get Wieters right.
Wieters, Wieters, whatever. What? I don't care. I think we've established that I do not pronounce names correctly.
It's probably because you don't watch or listen to baseball.
A lot of it is the fact that I don't listen to other baseball. So yeah, I never hear like announcers pronounce their names.
Not that announcers necessarily get the names right anyway.
Yeah, that's why I'm not that worried about Mike Trout, Bryce Harper.
We were talking about Harrison Profar. Well, there's no reason to care about I am so disinterested in the entire National League. It's like the only time you'll matter is if the Mariners are amazing. And well, I'm going to go ahead and just not worry about that.
Or I guess next year when we're always playing interleague.
Yeah.
Then it'll sort of matter again.
It's still not going to play the National League very often. How much does it get boosted, the number of games against the NL?
I have no idea.
Not either.
Not actually much. It just gets spread out all over the season.
But, yeah, and that was going to be going on all the time. But I like, okay, so I'm looking
at thank God, because then maybe people will stop pretending like Interleague is special, because it's not anymore.
I mean, I'm looking at, apparently the Nationals are 10-4. Great for them. I don't care. I don't know anything about what the Nationals are doing, yeah. I assume.
It's nice when, because it's funny, like, because you get emotionally distant from, like, the National League, and then you see things like that, and you're more able to be the objective analyst and be like, whatever, small sample size, and not care. But then the second you start talking about, like, the, not you, but just people in general, you get to something where you're actually more attached to or emotionally invested in, and suddenly all the biases just creep all the way back in, and you're like, panic.
You know who's terrible is the Cubs. You want to talk about the Cubs?
Are, like, they?
Ordinarily, we talk about the Astros being terrible, but at least the Astros are... Well, we know that we've established that the Astros are terrible, but the Cubs are 3-10, which is, of course, not, you know, it's early. But you also, you look at that lineup, it's like, whoa, okay, I totally get it. Where, you know who's the best hitter on the team so far? Brian Lehair, who's actually been good. He's been very good so far. But, oh, God, that team is just a complete wreck this year, which I think people were prepared for, but, oh, it's just... I don't have any reason to not like the Cubs, but I don't like the Cubs at all. So it's funny when they're bad.
Yeah. I don't like the Cubs either.
That's
so.
Where Sean Kemp is, it turns out. Sean Kemp has no walks in 5 appearances.
Oh.
Remember when he was a Mariner?
Yeah, I didn't know he got picked up by anybody.
Yeah,
oh, good for him.
The Cubs. He got a job. Hong-Chi Kuo does not have a job.
Yeah, I don't think he's getting one.
Man, that was exciting at the time. Well, it wasn't exciting. It was not unexciting. Well, no, it was unexciting.
It was unexpected, was and unexpected is always exciting.
Yeah, it was a potential bargain.
Yeah, God, we thought that totally screwed up the entire bullpen. And then, nope, neither of them made the team. Which was weird. They were so quick to cut bait on both Sean Kemp and Hong-Chi Kuo, who they nominally signed to kind of major league contracts. I mean... At least invested some money in them, and I don't know. It gives me kind of hope that maybe if, hopefully not even till June, maybe if it's like mid-May and Miguel Olivo is still Miguel Olivo, that they'll just finally just be like, no, you're cut. God, I'll buy cake that day.
And eat it?
I'll probably share it. I don't want to eat an entire cake. But, yeah, no, I'll buy a cake. To celebrate the day Miguel Olivo is no longer a Mariner.
You can understand why they were so quick to cut bait with Kuo, because I think he had demonstrated.
Yeah. Well, yeah, like, we knew. Okay. It was like, oh, this is a risk, and here's the risk, and here's the warning signs, and whoa, here's all the warning signs, and some new ones.
I can't see anything but red flags. Yeah. But then with Kemp, it's like, I'm pretty sure he was fine.
He was, he was totally fine. Like, his strikeouts and walks were, like, fun. Yeah. And I was like, whoop, no, you're cut.
maybe Eric Ward is like, oh, wait, no, we only need 3 relievers. I forgot. So, wait, I mean, I don't even know why you're here. I've got Will Helmsen League and Delabar. What else could you possibly need? But, yeah, that was hasty and unexpected, which was interesting because it's interesting when baseball takes us by surprise, except when it takes us by surprise like last night, even though I guess, as you said, last night didn't take you by surprise. It took me by surprise.
Well, and it's still interesting. It's just not good interesting.
Right.
Adjectives don't have to necessarily be positive or negative.
Yeah, God, interesting is... I have a beef with the way people use interesting, and people take interesting as being so dismissive. If somebody says something to you, sends you a link or something, you're like, oh, that's interesting. They'll think that you're just blowing them off. But no, if I say something's interesting, it's like, oh, I am interested in what you have presented to me. That mm-hmm. is a high compliment or a claim.
Well, yeah. Text-based communication has really turned a lot of things into just sarcasm. Like, they can only be read in sarcasm. It also happened, I think, like 2 years ago or something. You posted something about, like hockey starting at some point in a game thread, and I responded with, oh boy. And then you took it as me just like totally blowing you off. And I was like, no, that was just me being all like old, like using old folksy language. I was like, I'm also excited about the start of the hockey season, but you can't see somebody post "oh boy!" exclamation point and not read it in a "oh yeah" wanking motion. And you're right. I think interesting is kind of is at least starting to creep to that point where it's just like, oh, well, fuck you.
I was watching this was a hockey highlight the other day, and there were two players who had just finished fighting, or somebody dove or something. It was something that was controversial that happened. And then a player had gotten up, like the guy who was getting a penalty had gotten up. The referee was guiding him to the penalty box, and the player in the background did the dismissive wanking motion. And I thought, you never see that shit in baseball. Like, nobody's ever like... queer. Like, you just, it's baseball has so much, there's so much more emotion and aggression in hockey, which is dumb, and it's so childish, but it's hilarious to see the players do that. And like, they'll, the other day, and we're getting, God, I just can't not talk about hockey right now, but the other day, a player in Ottawa got into a fight with a player for New York, and after the fight was over, both players were going to the penalty box, and then the Ottawa player was being guided by the referee, and he, like, fake... like, pounced. He just did a little motion, like he was coming at the other player, just like a blink of an eye, quick motion that was fake. And it was hilarious, because he's like, oh, he just lunged at the player. It's like, he's just trying to intimidate him now. Or, like, imagine if when... remember when Jared Weaver got ejected last year for, like, throwing at the Tigers or something, and there was this whole to-do, or... actually, no, let's take this. Remember when Richie Sexton threw his helmet at the Rangers pitcher? So imagine Sexton, he got ejected, right? Because he threw his shit at the pitcher.
Yeah.
Imagine if Sexton had come off the field and, like, did the pump up the
little
crowd deep motion.
Yeah.
like a football player would. Like, nobody in baseball would ever do that. He'd probably get fined, like, $10 million because baseball is such a folksy game. But, oh, God, that shit would be so interesting to see. It would get me so much more interested in the game. I want to feel – one of the advantages – I felt really bad about this last night. When the Mariners lost, I was just – like, mad and sad and just fuming, and I just had to get... clearly, I had to get a bunch of words out of my system in a short amount of time. I'm usually not that fast, but I came... after I wrote that screed, which is basically what it was, I came away in a really happy mood, like, oh, shit, look how productive I was and how fast that was. I'm done at, like, 11 o'clock. Holy shit, the game ended an hour ago. I was so satisfied because it turns out... I can do that when I have emotions about the game, which I usually don't. Oh, the Mariners lost 5-3. Okay. Seen this game before. How am I supposed to make this interesting? But when you can feel, and that's one of the things about the NHL playoffs, is it's just so much, it's nothing but emotion. There is no objective analysis. I want a player on Ottawa to play through fucking concussion right now because I just want to win and see him play. That's retarded on my part. I'm sorry for using that word, retards. But when... with baseball, it's just there's not enough emotions. Too gentlemanly. It's not cricket, but it's just I want to see a little more. I want to see players that other people would hate. I want somebody that people hate on my team.
Yeah,
something to get the crowd going.
Yeah, your line about I either I can't wait or I wonder if the Mariners could ever do anything to make me that mad. Mm-hmm. From a couple recaps or previews or whatever ago,
it was word learning,
like,
actually.
Yeah. Like, I know what you were talking about, too, because it's like, you know, yeah, I sit there and I'll watch. I watched last night's meltdown, and I basically did not react. Part of it was because I was expecting it to happen, but also it was just like, baseball, April baseball. I mean, I'm not, and I'm pretty sang-froid in general about when it comes to things like sports, but I go to a soccer game, and I get, like, 3 or 4 beers in me beforehand, and I am... become like so belligerent and racist, which is weird, just mean, and I literally like want players to get seriously injured for just like the silliest things too. But it's just this nonstop emotional outburst that I guess maybe playoff baseball would make me feel that way again or something, but
or maybe
but even like baseball is just as a sport, it's just not set up that way because it's just there's so much halting in the action.
And there's an issue right now, I think, at this point in the season where it's so early, the standings don't matter at all, and each game is just a baseball game. We can't put it in a greater context. The Mariners aren't fighting for a playoff spot yet. Maybe come July, if they're in the same position where they're like a half game behind the wild card. Well, then all of a sudden, it's like right now we don't feel like they're playing for anything. We just feel like they're playing baseball. At least that's what it's like for me. But if it gets to be like last year, we're halfway through the season, they're still kind of like 500 in the race, then I'll start to care when they lose 17 games in a row. But when
I'll still care, but I don't think anything in baseball would ever get to that kind of emotional level.
No.
Like in the middle of a game. And I think actually it has more to do with the fact that the game, hockey and soccer, are both more free-flowing games. And for some reason, I just feel like that's more conducive to that kind of sort of sparking that kind of rage.
Okay, but what about the Carlos Beltran game, 2008? What did you feel then when he took out Felix?
You know, I felt anger, but I never, nowhere near as much anger as I felt on, like, a random soccer player kind of trying to sell a dive against my team. Like, there, I've, like, and that happens every game, and I've, like, the times I'm like, I want him dead for that. For, like, well, trying to embellish a foul.
The other day, I, as you know, I'll say the name Jason Spezza, but an Ottawa player got taken out on an offensive rush. He got hit fairly legally, not like a dirty hit. It was mostly just arms. He was basically pushed over, and he got hurt in a playoff game. He's a critical player for Ottawa. And the shit that came out of my mouth after that happened, I would feel so, I'm almost embarrassed that I am capable of saying the things that I was saying by myself in my apartment with the windows open, with nobody else around, just like unloading. Not even the guy who hit him fine. It was a good defensive play. Just the whole team. I just wanted Ottawa to literally skate on somebody's neck. I just want to see blood from the other team. It's like, oh my God, how am I like this? How is, I feel like I've just devolved by like a million years back into whatever we were back in our bloodthirsty days. But baseball just doesn't do that. And it feels good, but maybe it also feels horrible, but it feels good at the time to just get all of that out of your system. And I feel horrible afterwards, but I guess,
you know, perhaps interestingly, there's been at least a spate of recent research that suggests that early humans were less bloodthirsty and warfare-y than modern humans.
Well, then I was most involved on the other day.
And I think the theory was that, like, when we were more hunter-gatherers that inspire and also less numerous, that induced more cooperation. Mm-hmm. Whereas when we switched to agriculture and property and things like that, that
territorial
inspires more competition and territorialness. And that's basically been the rise of warfare.
All right. So
because when you're hunter-gatherers, who gives a shit who owns what land? It doesn't matter.
So when we're when I'm watching hockey, you're watching soccer, it turns out that we're actually the most evolved we've ever been.
Yeah, which is scary for the future, no. But no, a lot of it in soccer has to do, I think, with alcohol. But
yeah. Well, I mean, I was completely sober the other day watching Ottawa because it was right before a Mariners game. I knew I'd have to write, but I was watching it, and it's just, maybe it's just something about seeing players exhibit emotion, which you don't see in baseball. I mean, you'll see Michael Saunders swear a lot because he's not.
See, no, I don't think so because I was also thinking about NFL, and I was like, you know, there's never really been a time in the NFL that I get like that upset. I get upset, but I mean, not like hockey or soccer upset. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I started getting that theory of, like, because I mean, football is kind of it shares a lot more, I think, similarities with baseball than with soccer or hockey. It's very, here's a play and then pause, and then here's another play and then pause. And people like to talk about there being a lot more action in football, but there's really not. You can see that by just watching distilled games. They distill football games down to just the live action during the plays, and they're like 26 minutes long. Baseball's about the same length. And it's just, I think soccer and football and hockey are more just the fact that, like, the action is constantly going. I don't know why, but I think that might be the difference, at least for me.
It's reassuring to me to know that I can feel that kind of emotion about a sport because it kind of justifies it. Like, it's fun to feel that much emotion about anything, even if it's sometimes negative emotion, but It's just nice to know that it's not a complete waste of time, that I actually do enjoy this and get something out of this sometimes, but it's also a little embarrassing when it happens. But I guess with something like with Felix coming off in the eighth inning yesterday, that was a weird way to pronounce that word, yesterday, Ms. Jeff is going to Indianapolis pretty soon for a conference, and I really wanted to just go and keep referring to it as Indianapolis, just like she'd never even heard of the city. Just saying it over and over. So we're trying to condition her now to get that into her system. So she goes, like, welcome to beautiful Indianapolis. I guess she'd be welcoming herself. Then all the people in Indianapolis would be like, oh, we would be critical to you, except we are the most plain people in the universe. How would you like a canister of oatmeal without water or seasoning? Here it is. We bathe in this, too. And also, our river is made of wheat. But with Felix getting that last strikeout in the eighth inning, it was not only such an emotional lift because he got the strikeout and the game was preserved, but just seeing him come off the mound, I could feed off his emotion. And it's so rare to see a Mariner react to something like that. And it's pretty much only Felix who does that, except for
I'm always positively to, anyways. Yeah, there's Michael Saunders who reacts that way negatively. I think also probably a lot of it has to do for me that like I watch the game alone and I don't watch soccer alone. So that doesn't explain you, but I don't know. I'm sure if I was with other people watching the Mariner game, I would have been a lot more psyched up when Felix did that. But also, I was watching the game at the gym, so maybe that kind of like dulled my emotion because I had an easy outlet for my emotion right there rather than like yelling obscenities. It was like, nope, just going to do more bench presses harder and faster or something.
Yeah, we've been talking for a long time.
Yeah.
I think we're at roughly 73 minutes.
Okay. So we need to end with on something, and I will give you a choice of two things. One, we haven't talked about volcanoes yet, nor in any kind of recent podcast. Option two, which is a victim of the fact that I keep my Twitter feed up and I subscribe to numerous science feeds, but a study that just came across my Twitter feed: men prefer pink female genitals to red, study finds. Which would you like to comment on?
I think we can blend the two of these together somehow. If you give me a few minutes.
What the hell, live science?
I can't even. I don't. I would need 3 hours to prepare even like a 2-sentence statement of a response to study headline because I can't imagine a certain like, oh, this is. Blood. This is blood.
No.
I mean, this is only blood. I'm not sexually attracted to blood. No. I can't. No. I'm sorry. I don't even have anything interesting volcanic to talk about, right? Okay. No, I got one. Okay. So there's a volcano in Iceland. I'm going to butcher this. I'm going to go ahead and call it Grímsvötn. And maybe that's wrong, but it's close. And everybody knows about the Eyjafjallajökull, the eruption. A few years ago, all the flights and everything. So this Grímsvötn eruption was literally 100 times as powerful, but because it was in a more isolated area and didn't hit the same wind currents, it got a lot less press. But now Grímsvötn erupted what's called tephra, which is basically, you know, volcanic shit, ash and rocks and stuff that is really hot and it comes out of the volcano and it covers the land around. And because this is Iceland, it covered a land covered in snow. So there's just this whole blanket of tephra over, like, unthinkable square miles, and it's just black tephra that's more thick in certain places than it is in other places, and it's just, but the whole landscape is like a tephra beach except without water. Now, that's all coating snow, so because the tephra is black, as you can understand, it absorbs the sun's heat, right? So it's heating up the tephra and the snow underneath. But so you have what looks like a whole pretty uniform layer of tephra over the landscape, but where the tephra is thicker, it insulates more the heat that it absorbs, so it doesn't melt the snow below it. Where the tephra is thinner, it does melt the snow below it. So over time, what you end up happening is that you get these like tephra cones, because in some places the snow has melted where it's thinner, and in other places it hasn't melted where it's thicker, so the landscape becomes more and more irregular over time as it absorbs more heat, which I thought was really, really interesting.
Does it like eventually solidify in any kind of like rock-like?
The tephra?
The tephra, yeah.
No, if you think about, like, when we hiked some of Mount Hood last year, it's just kind of an ashy landscape. I mean, that stuff doesn't fuse. It's just, once it's
cold. Yeah, so it's like, well, I mean, like, if you went there to go visit and see it and you walked on it, would it basically just all collapse?
I don't think it would all collapse because it's pretty thick. And also, I mean, the snow down there is pretty cold. It would just be, you know, grainy.
Well, I didn't mean, like, collapse to the center of the earth or something. Like,
well, I also didn't mean that, but thanks for the hyperbole. No, I'm sure it is some kind of fragile. I don't know how fragile it is, but it's not like it's that.
I guess because I'm thinking of it as more like ash, I guess, maybe, instead of just like an ash.
It's like, but also
rock
a
mix.
Bigger.
Yeah.
But it won't fuse. It's just going to be rainy and shit, and then it'll get covered by more snow, and then it'll just become part of the landscape. But right now, little tephra cones.
Cool.
Yep.
All right, so there's your volcano for the week or something. I don't know.
I think we picked it up in the last half hour. I'm proud of that. Too bad nobody did this far.
Well, that's too bad because I missed some fascinating science.
Tephra cones. All right, well, until next time. Oh, something. It's 10:37 in the morning. I smell weed and I forgot that it's 4:20. All right. Well, yeah. Everybody have a fantastic time listening to this podcast later on. And maybe we'll be back next week. We will probably be back next week, but I'll make no guarantees. Matthew, do you have a closing line? No, you don't. All right. See you guys.